Hello and welcome to Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong, speaking to you from here in Istanbul. In this podcast, we hear from authors of newly released books on Turkey and its region. Subscribe through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher or Acast. Like the Facebook page, follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk. Check out show notes and other links at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com and rate or review the podcast wherever you listen to it. Let me once again alert you to Turkey Book Talk's new membership system. If you want extra benefits and content while also supporting the podcast going forward, then do consider becoming a member. If you sign up as a paying member, you'll get access to full transcripts in both English and Turkish of every interview published on Turkey Book Talk in PDF form as soon as the episode is published. You'll also receive transcripts of the entire Turkey Book Talk archive in English, which amounts to over 60 conversations so far. Most of these transcripts were previously published at the Hurriyet Daily News, but from now on, a Turkey Book Talk membership is the only way to access them. And that archive also includes a number of interviews not previously published on the podcast. As a member, you will also get access to a special 30% discount on Turkey and Ottoman history books published by IB Taurus. IB Taurus have a fantastic archive of titles and have made over 200 books from their Turkey Ottoman history series available at cut price, exclusive to Turkey Book Talk members through a special discount code. A number of IB Taurus authors have appeared on the podcast in the past, so becoming a member is obviously a great way to get more acquainted with their work. If you do become a member, you'll be helping us develop the podcast, and if more members sign up, we may end up being able to start publishing a new episode every week, up from the current one episode every 2 weeks. So to become a Turkey Book Talk member, all you have to do is pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Turkey Book Talk's official Patreon account. At present, we post new episodes bi-weekly, so the monthly membership price is no more than $6. If we end up becoming able to publish a new episode every week, then that will go up to $12 monthly maximum, which is not too bad a deal. Of course, if you're feeling particularly generous and want to pledge more, then everything helps and you'll certainly be more than welcome. But so long as you pledge $3 or above per episode, membership is entirely at your own discretion. Members are only charged when a new episode is published, so there are no prior commitments or strings attached. You'll be free to sign off whenever you want. So do consider taking advantage of the membership system. You can find details of how to sign up via armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com or through any of the other Turkey Book Talk pages. But now let's get on with our latest episode. In it, we welcome Diana Dark. She's the author of the book The Merchant of Syria, A Story of Survival, which has just been published by Hearst. The book tells the story of Abu Chaker, a cloth merchant from Homs who lived from 1921 to 2013 and who had a truly remarkable and tumultuous life. Despite being barely literate and having to leave school to support his mother and seven sisters from the age of 10, Abu Chaker managed to build up a business empire spanning Syria and Lebanon. From the 1980s, he also spread his operations to Britain, where he rescued a failing Yorkshire textile mill called Heald Brothers and transformed it into a global brand. Today, that mill is the only textile mill still operating in the post-industrial northern town of Bradford. The Merchant of Syria tells the story of Abu Chaker's life in parallel with the story of the modern history of Syria itself, examining the social, cultural, and political context that shaped his life. It also touches on the emergence of the ongoing war in Syria, which Diana herself witnessed as she was living in a historical courtyard house in the old town of Damascus until just a few years ago. We talk about all that later in the conversation, but I started by asking Diana Dark to introduce Abu Chaker, who he was, and what made his life attractive for such a project.
Well, yes. I mean, the life of Abu Chaker really gives the opportunity to shine a light on the socio-economic history of Syria from the end of the Ottoman Empire up to the present day, because Abu Chaker himself was a textile merchant from Homs. He was born in 1921, so he was born essentially straight after World War I into a Syria that was in total turmoil. And so by following his struggles through the political turmoil that Syria then went through, it gives a chance to look at how on earth did ordinary people survive, business people like him, how did they manage in this absolutely chaotic environment? It was just like a political roller coaster. And this is where I found the main themes of the book started to come out, basically, because it began to show that the way people survived in this political turbulence was to ignore the government, essentially, and say, well, forget about about the government. We clearly can't rely on them. You know, they're unreliable. We can't respect them. We can't trust them. We're never going to get anything from them. So we'll do it ourselves. And so that is how this this sort of sense of community seems to have built up, where communities looked after themselves. That's one of the sort of key messages that I found came through in the book. And this is nothing purely Muslim. I mean, Abu Shakir himself is a Sunni Muslim, as are most Syrians. But it wasn't about that. It's a much bigger story than just his particular religion, which was very, very important to him. He's a devout Sunni Muslim. But he had business people who were from all religions. So, you know, he had partners who were Christian, who were Jewish, who were Druze. None of that mattered. It was all about whether you were an honest person. That's sort of one of the key things that comes through in his life. But he was not unusual. That's the other point. He becomes a sort of archetypal merchant because this was how most business people were. It was their way of surviving.
You are family friends with his family. I mean, Abu Shakir died a couple of years ago, but you are friends of his family. What's their reception to the project and the book been, and how closely did you work with them?
Well, they asked me to write their father's story, basically. I mean, I knew Abu Shakir himself as an old man. I met him first in 2005, straight after I'd bought my house in Damascus. I met the youngest son, Abu Shakir's youngest son, by total chance on a flight out to Syria, a Syrian Air flight to Damascus. And just by chance, we were sat next to each other. It was the one and only time in my life where I'd been bumped up to first class, because I got to know the Syrian Airlines manager quite well because I was flying to and fro a lot at that time during the buying of the house. And so, total chance, I met this young Syrian guy who, you know, we got on very well. And then after we both arrived in Syria, he said, oh, well, look, you know, you must come up and visit the family. And sure enough, he then rang me at my house in Damascus and said, well, why don't you come up and visit, you know, stay up here a few days. So I did, and we went up, and that's when I first met Abu Shakir, who as his son had warned me, was a man of very few words. He said remarkably little, but he had these incredibly piercing blue eyes, which would sort of pin you. You could sort of feel them drilling right through you and sizing you up. And one of his friends actually joked that he was the only man they ever knew who was fluent in five languages without ever saying a word. I mean, you did get that sense about him. And his sons clearly held him in massive respect. I mean, they always went to visit him in the summer, so quite a lot of the family was actually staying there as well. And I just stayed in touch with them. And so when he then died in 2013, they actually, within days, came to me and said, look, will you write his story? We tried to persuade him to let us do something about his life while he was still alive, but he refused and said, no, don't bother about me. You know, you go off, look after your own life. But now that he's died, we would really like some sort of record of his story. So I agreed. And they said, look, we'll set up, you know, interviews for you with people who knew him, who worked with him. And I said, fine, good, you know, I'll do all that. I interviewed all the family members, all the grandchildren. And I said to them, look, I can write his story, if you like, but I can never guarantee that this book would be published because people may not be that interested in just the life of one man. But as I started to write it, and I should actually say I have written two versions. I've written a version for the family, which has got a lot more personal information in it. And that's purely for their consumption within the family. But then I said to them, after I'd done that, I said, look, I think your father's story could be very useful as a platform to show how people generally lived in this time and a way of explaining about the socio-economic side of Syria that not that many people look at. You know, all the focus seems to be on politics and history, but the socio-economics is a very under-researched area. So I said I'd like to have a go at trying to, you know, make him into an archetypal merchant, if you like. And they liked the idea, and so I then set about doing it. It took a long time. It has been 4 years in the research, and it's been really very hard finding some of the material because, as I said, not much has been written. So the source material I used was incredibly diverse from everywhere and everything I could think of, gathering little tiny bit here, tiny bits there, and trying to weave it all together into something that would make sense. And the person who actually helped me with this most of all was my brother, my own brother, who has never been to Syria, but he's retired now, so I knew he would have the time. time. So I showed him my early drafts and said, look, what do you think? And he just laughed and said, well, you haven't got a book then. And he explained why he thought that. And so in a funny sort of way, the more he told me it wasn't going to work, the more determined I became to make it work. So my brother played an incredibly useful role in that. And I didn't show the manuscript to anybody, not even the sons themselves, until I was pretty sure, right, this is going to work now in this sort of parallel structure that I went for in the end. Because when my brother said, right, at first you had no book and now you've got two books, I thought, well, that doesn't help me much. How do I manage that now with two books? And he said, well, you've got the story of the man and you've got the beginnings of a socioeconomic history. And so I thought, right, okay, well, so how do I reconcile that? So it was, again, just a casual email to a friend saying, oh, you know, this book, I don't seem to be able to get anywhere with it. You know, I'm beginning to wonder if it's going to work. And he just replied and said, well, why don't you think about a parallel structure? The minute he said that, I thought, wow, that's it. That's the brainwave. Yes, I think I can do it that way. So I immediately set about restructuring the book along those lines. And I kind of knew, right, this works now. This is going to be okay.
Abu Chaker's story is absolutely fascinating when you just put the bare bones of the bare details of his life on paper. He was born in Homs in 1921, I believe, and he had to abandon school after his father died when he was just 10 years old. So he left school, he was illiterate, and started work. But from that very low base, he ended up building this kind of multinational business empire. And that's what the book does. It sort of tells the story of his life and his experiences. Obviously, researching his life must have been very different as an experience to researching the kind of modern history of Syria itself. Could you just talk a bit about his life, you know, what his origins were, what his family background was, and how his position changed over the years?
His own ancestry was Ottoman. We traced his family back to the original Shamsi Pasha, who was called Ahmed Shamsi Pasha, who was actually the hunting companion to Suleiman the Magnificent. So Ahmed Shamsi Pasha was a good friend, I mean, a sort of entertainer. He was a poet and hunting companion to Suleiman the Magnificent. He then managed to stay in favor as the drinking companion to Selim II, and then also as the sort of trusted confidant of Murad III. So he stayed in favor with three consecutive Ottoman sultans. And interestingly, he achieved that by keeping out of politics, by keeping out of the court intrigues. And what happened was that he was sent to be governor of Damascus by Suleiman the Magnificent. And whilst he was there, what we uncovered is that he seems to have got into the broadcloth trade, English Yorkshire woolen cloth, which is very well known for its warmth and its very high quality. And so he built the very first khan in the Damascus souk to store this very valuable broadcloth. That khan is still there, incredibly. So from that, we realized that the tradition, as is normal in Syria, for a trade to pass down through the family generations. And so the broadcloth trade is what was the family profession. And Abu Shakir in Homs, when his father died, when he was only 10, he suddenly had to look after his mother and seven sisters. He was the only son. And so his life completely changed overnight because he was born into a relative privilege, you know, sort of quite well-off family, living in a nice courtyard house in the old city in Homs. So everything changed for him overnight. Boom, you know, his completely life was turned upside down. So that was his first family tragedy. The second family tragedy was that he was forced to marry his first cousin, as again was quite normal in Syria. And that was a disaster, ended in divorce, very bitter family feud, family recriminations. So really, he had these two early family tragedies, which he managed to recover from. Then he had the business tragedies. So he lost everything in Syria under the sort of nationalization. A lot of his the family wealth was confiscated and this kind of thing. So he moved discreetly to Beirut to begin building up the business again. Lost everything again when the Lebanese civil war broke out. So in a way, this is why his story can sort of give young Syrians today hope that in spite of all this personal tragedy, this commercial tragedy, things going wrong in your life, you can still come through if you have the right attitude and you're a highly respected person. And everybody respected Abu Shakir because what he demonstrated in the way he lived his life and the way he ran his business was that he was a man totally of his word. Once he'd given his word on something and a deal had been agreed, it didn't even have to be written down. People knew he would stick to it. And so because of that, even when he lost everything, the bank banks, for example, in Lebanon, lent him money to start up all over again because they knew that he would pay them back. He behaved the same way with other protégés himself. So when young people just starting out in business came to him, he would lend them money. He would say, look, okay, I trust you. Here's some money for you to get started with. Off you go. Do your best and pay me back when you can. He just trusted people like that. You know, one of his sons said to me, the key for their success was because of this trust, basically. We were the kings in the market because we were trusted. And so when he then came over, when he lost everything in Lebanon in the Civil War, he came over to London and ended up buying the mill in Bradford that produced this broadcloth that he was trading, that was the subject of a takeover bid, you know, and he was horrified that the source of his trading was going to be lost. So he was persuaded to start bidding to buy the shares. He didn't understand anything about the whole business of shares. You know, it was a complete eye-opener to him that somebody could just come along and buy your company and take it away. So it turned into a six-month takeover battle, which he eventually won. And at that point, he immediately took the company private and said, right, well, I'm never going to have that again. I'm not going to have somebody take the company away. And so once he had his supply then secure, and he kept all the same staff, he kept everything the same, he really looked after the employees in Bradford. And to this day, that is still the only mill in Bradford that's working. And he used that to build up a global empire, textile trading, which is what his sons run now.
One of the things that the book does very nicely, I think, is it weaves in, as we mentioned before there, this kind of personal story of Abu Chaker, his family life, his business life, with the kind of broader historical and social context that he lived through. So by looking at his life and the background of his family, you're really able to kind of excavate the late Ottoman period, the French Mandate, independent Syria with its litany of coups, the Ba'athist regime of the al-Assads, and the breaking out of the civil war that's still going on. And it's really impressive research that you've put in, very detailed, and you learn a lot from it. It's clear that you put a lot of work into it. Was that a big challenge? How much elbow grease did you have to put into that research?
Well, a great deal. Yes, I did have to work at it very hard and do a lot of blue sky thinking, if you like, because there wasn't anything to follow as a model. I mean, I'm not aware of a book that's done anything like this before on Syria. And in a way, I mean, that's what makes me very pleased about it, because it's kind of evolved from quite a deep knowledge of Syria now over the years, and thinking, you know, how can I make this man's life useful? As I mentioned about the parallel structure, the thing I really wanted to do, the thing that for me actually was the biggest motivator, was to make the final chapter where the two strands, the socioeconomic background and the man himself, those two strands are woven together into what is actually the longest chapter of the book, the final chapter, saying, okay, this is the life, you know, he lived. What can we learn? What is this telling us about the future of Syria? Because one of the things I noticed in a lot of my research when I was reading other people's books is that people are very reluctant to do this, to sort of project to the future. They like to sort of focus on everything that has happened and analyze that. And I always think, what's the point of that in a way, unless you're going to use that to project forward, to try to think constructively about where this is pointing us. So it's that final chapter to me was the important thing. And actually, just to mention again, you know, that you did say about, you know, the family's reaction to the book. I mean, they are thrilled to bits with the book. I mean, they are really, really excited about it. And, you know, they're delighted that, you know, the book is sort of their father's legacy on one level, but also the fact that it's making a useful contribution, and the fact that it supports this charity too, you know, this Culture Through Making initiative, which is another sort of very positive, you know, hands-on thing that can point to the future, you know, something that can concretely come out of the book, a whole initiative that is based on hope and future, keeping alive Syria's traditional craft skills, helping people to and means of earning money too in the future if the handicraft skills in all the rebuilding projects that will one day be possible. All these skills are going to become very important.
Which fits very nicely actually into my next question, because something that you make clear throughout the book really is that religion and commerce have always really gone hand in hand in Syria and this part of the world. And of course Abu Chaker was a merchant, but as you make clear throughout the book, he was a very pious man, a believing Sunni Muslim, and those two strands of his life were closely intertwined really. And that really is based on a historical foundation really, because mosques historically going back centuries have always been built built at the centre of elaborate social and commercial complexes, and they are often funded by foundations or wealthy merchants. And it may almost seem counterintuitive to some people these days, but both religion and commerce have long been kind of fundamental building blocks of Syrian society, which you can't really separate from each other.
No, that's right. Again, that's something that I wasn't particularly aware of myself when I started all the research, but that very much came out of it. And so I felt it was very important to explain all about the waqf system, you know, having the mosque supported the income stream generated by the commercial buildings all around the mosque. So that could be shops, it could be the hammam, could be schools, you know, and these are ways of generating income to pay the salaries of the teachers in the schools, the doctors, the muezzins in the mosque. And what this shows you is how different the motivation was for wealth creation in that society. And so for Abu Shakir, and again, here he's just an archetype, this is normal, the motivation for him to make money was first and foremost to look after his family. But then beyond that, any money that is left, you give to the community to help those that are less fortunate. And so all his life, it was just instinctive to give money away to orphanages, to people who'd fallen on hard times. If any of his employees died or had a relation who died, he would always support that family until they could get back on their feet again. And it struck me how different this approach is to our sort of corporate finance mentality, you know, the big corporate psyche that we are used to, where basically you try to put your competitors out of business. It's all about pushing ahead at the expense of your competitors. It's a totally different approach because in Abu Shakir's time, there were cases of, for example, a Christian merchant going bankrupt in the souk and his Muslim shop owner friends, his neighbours in the souk, clubbing together to help him and to make sure he did not go bankrupt. Bankruptcy was regarded as a social failure. They just wouldn't allow it to happen, so they would make sure that everybody thrived. So even if somebody came to their shop and they'd already had three customers that day, they would direct them to the neighbour's shop and say, no, it's a go to my neighbour. He hasn't had any customers today. And all of that, this sort of look at the community looking after itself. And I began to wonder, you know, is this partly because, you know, the government isn't going to do it? So one of the sort of lessons, if you like, that started to come out of all of this was, well, in Syria, as long as you've got a government that no one can trust or depend on or respect, then, you know, you're going to continue to see society working in its own ways to sort of look after itself. And of course, the good people do it in this very moral way. But sadly, of course, you also, in a war such as is going on in Syria at the moment, you get those, you know, who abuse the system and take advantage of the lawlessness. And so, and of course, in the West, we tend to only hear about that side of things. So I saw, you know, Abu Shakir's story as a way of saying, look, you know, it's not all bad. You do have good merchants who stick to the true principles of it all. And if we could only replicate his story, you know, things could get very, very much better.
On this question, it does remind me, actually, in Turkey, in Ankara, the main Kocatepe Mosque, right there towards the centre of the city, was built, I think, in the 80s, and it raised a lot of eyebrows, and people still laugh at it now, because it's basically this mosque that's enormous. It's the biggest mosque in the city, I think, and it's also underneath it, it's got this multi-storey shopping centre and multi-storey car park, which is a kind of funny, modern iteration of this tradition of the merchant and religious impulse going hand in hand. And also actually the new mosque that's currently being built on Taksim Square is going to have a 5-story car park underneath it, apparently. So I suppose the tradition continues strongly, at least in Turkey. You recently published a article on the BBC website, which was about the Syrian district of Afrin in northwest Syria, which of course has been the site of a recent Turkish incursion against the YPG, and Turkey actually took Afrin and is now the kind of occupying force there, along with the Free Syrian Army. I wonder if you could just kind of give your reflections. It's a bit of a mysterious area, really, Afrin. People don't really know that much about it outside. It's a kind of forgotten corner of Syria, but now, of course, it's become a very important site. I wonder if you could just kind of share with listeners your reflections on Afrin, how long ago you went, what you went for, and what kind of a place is it, or was it at the time, at least?
Well, when I first went there, it was part of my researches for writing the Brat Guide to Syria. So I was going to all corners of the country at that time. And Afrin, the reason I was going there, it's obviously north of Aleppo, right up on the, close to the Turkish border. And the reason to go there was there are two archaeological sites that are quite significant. The main Neo-Hittite site in Syria is actually at a place called Ain Dara, which is in the Afrin Valley. So it's actually very, very beautiful. It's on a hill, like all the Hittite sites, and it overlooks this beautifully fertile, treed valley, you know, beautiful poplar trees, olive trees, very, very rich fruit trees. So that was the first site I went to, which is about an hour's drive north of Aleppo. And then I continued right up to get to, it's a Roman site called Cyrus. The local name for it is Anabi Huri, and it's an unexcavated site right on the Turkish border there. So this was the reason for me going there, and there are beautiful Roman bridges that you have to cross to get up there. There have actually been some work on the Afrin River, some dams, so the road there was not straightforward because following the map, suddenly the road disappeared into a lake that hadn't been there at the time the map was being made, because the Midanki Falls, the quite famous waterfalls there, were suddenly no longer there because of a dam, so a reservoir had been created there. So we had to find a back route, and this meant that we had to drive up through a lot of the villages. Well, have been caught, if you like, in first in the Kurdish fighting, and now in the Turkish fighting. So it was very interesting to drive through those areas. I've made two visits there actually. The first one would have been in 2004, and the second visit was in 2010, when I was actually just travelling around with my husband and my son because they hadn't been up there before. And the villages, they were very clearly heavily agricultural villages, very rich red soil, people just living off the agriculture, and clearly a Kurdish population. I mean, it is known as the Mountain of the Kurds locally.
Now, just to conclude, really, this book comes after your last book, My House in Damascus, which was published a few years ago. And we actually spoke about it in what was just the second ever Turkey Book Talk episode, actually. So people can go back and listen to that if they really want to hear that. And that book described your experiences in Syria. You basically bought and renovated a 17th century courtyard house in Damascus's old town, and you lived there for a number of years, right up until the civil war broke out. And after that civil war broke out, the house was basically seized, really, occupied by war profiteers in the chaos of the war. And I wonder if you could just update us, really, on what's the latest with that house.
Yes, well, as you say, it was basically taken from me. I mean, I had five Syrian refugee families, friends of mine, living in the house perfectly well for about 3 years. But that all came crashing down when my original lawyer, decided that he would steal the house from me. So in cahoots with the previous owner, he put a case through the courts. He forged my signature, said I'd sold the house back to him voluntarily with all my furniture, and to get my friends out of the house, he wrote an intelligence report against me, saying that I was a British terrorist, that I had links with armed groups in the Ghouta, because one of the families living in the house, the family of my caretaker, was from the Ghouta, so that automatically made me a terrorist. So on the strength of that, soldiers came to the house, arrested all my friends, put them in prison, tortured some of them, complete disaster, basically. So I had to go back and challenge that situation. And to my astonishment, and I mean, the publishers of my house in Damascus allowed me to add two extra chapters for the third edition describing my trip back to regain the house. It was the most exciting 2 weeks of my life, but against all the odds, I did actually succeed in throwing out the bad lawyer, his mistress, the baby that had been born in the house, and what I call the fake general, who was an armed military guy living in the house as a sort of bodyguard, if you like. But by challenging them and taking them completely by surprise, because they'd never dreamt I would get back into the country, but I was given a visa to go back legally. So I was able to challenge them and throw them out in the end. And now I have metal doors on the house to make sure that the door can't be smashed down anymore. And I have a friend living there, just one family now, him and his extended family. He's a restoration architect. And because he has a kind of diplomatic immunity working for the Aga Khan Foundation, he can't be touched. So that he lives in the house safely. He's been there now for the last years, and he looks after it. I don't charge him any rent, and my dream is that one day the house can be a cultural institute of some sort, maybe for the Aga Khan Foundation. I would love that. That would be a wonderful outcome from my point of view.
So how long ago was that when you last went back?
That was right at the very end of 2014, so it's just over 3 years ago now.
Has there been any damage at all to the structure there, or is it in a...
No, the old city of Damascus, I mean, gets the occasional mortar shell landing in it from rebel areas, from the Houthi. But the house, although it was narrowly missed by two mortar shells back in September that hit the neighbours' houses, and a couple of neighbours were actually killed in that strike, the friend who's living in the house, he has this, you know, the Syrian sense of humour is incredible. He's building up this incredible collection of shrapnel that lands in the courtyard. And so he sends me photos of the sort of growing collection of shrapnel bits and bullets and whatever that have been landing in the courtyard over the years. And it's quite a collection now, actually. But as I said, they just laugh about it, actually, and get on with it. Because what can you do? You know, they know that they've got no power whatsoever to change what's going on in this war. So they just get on with their lives as best they can.
That was Diana Dark. Many thanks to her. If you want to check out her earlier appearance on the podcast a couple of years ago, discussing her previous book, My House in Damascus, which was actually only the second ever episode of Turkey Book Talk, then have a search on Google or click on the link that I put up at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. Also, do remember to consider joining the Turkey Book Talk membership system. The deal is not bad value at all. If you pledge a minimum of $3 per episode, you'll get access to transcripts in English and Turkish of every episode as it's published, as well as the entire Turkey Book Talk archive, and also exclusive access to a special 30% discount on a selection of over 200 books on Turkey and Ottoman history published by IB Taurus. You'll be helping Turkey Book Talk keep the show on the road, developing further and providing a bigger platform for our guests and their work. Find links with information on how to sign up on all the Turkey Book Talk websites. Also, spare a minute or two to rate or review Turkey Book Talk on whatever podcast platform you listen on. You can follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page to stay updated with new episodes, and send any recommendations, feedback or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. But until the next episode of Turkey Book Talk in a couple of weeks, thank you very much for listening. Seçtiğim sensin, bütün dünyayı gezdim.